And crypto hunter John Rhodes, our guest tonight. Next hour, we'll take phone calls, but lots more to talk with him. And how about later on, 14,000 miles an hour through a tube shuttle. Can you believe that? All of that's next on Coast to Coast AM. John, let's talk a little bit more about UFO sightings now from all around the world. They seem to be showing an increase in reptoid-type sightings. South America, Central, North America, Japan, all over the place.
That's correct. I believe that what we're seeing is the beginning of the emergence, or some people would say it might be the great revealing, as in Revelation, that everybody's been looking forward to. I think that people are also being more open to sharing these experiences. For many years, the individuals who are having experiences that were more neutral or beneficial to them, spiritually or psychologically, were withholding their information and coming forward because they recognized that there seems to be a lot of generated angst amongst the public to want to vilify them, and they felt that if they brought their stories forward, they would just be attacked. And in many cases, that's exactly what's happening. But you're also having an emergence of a reptiliform symbol in end times, as we call it, or we think that it might be. And if you look back at so many of these different cultures that have reptilian symbols in their mythologies, they always talk about something that's going to be returning, including Quetzalcoatl. You recognize that, for example, we have reptilian humanoid sightings down in Mexico, but you could correlate with that with all the sightings that they've been having in their craft down there. Why down there? Why not over any other city? Why does it seem to be there so openly, more so than anywhere else in the world, where entire freeways stop and thousands of people get out and look at them?
They're coming back home.
Well, that very well could be the case. We have, you know, when you think of it from an alchemical point of view, because alchemy is a really interesting study in as much as it encapsulates the study of symbols and their connections with the human spirit. It never really truly meant, let's try and make gold out of lead. It really meant, let's try and see if we can control our thoughts and control our beliefs to the point of where we could have spiritual growth, because that will always be with you. The gold will always be left behind. And so when you start looking at the symbols that are being used by aliens, like in crop circles and the like, you recognize that that there are symbolic events that also take place, that if they're really beings who look at symbols more than they do concepts like we do, then when you have things like 2012, or you have the second crossing of the pair of Venus between Earth and Venus in 2011, we have different types of things, just even in, like Revelation, where they talk about the great dragons being, you know, coming forth and such like that. You're getting these reports because more people are sensitive to their own local belief systems, and it may be influencing their dreams and what they're feeling. There's a certain amount of that happening. But there's also the definitive reports that have multiple eyewitnesses that are seeing the same being at the same time. So we're having a physical thing happen here as well.
What do you think people would do, society, how would it react, if they actually saw these creatures walking around on the surface?
Well, we're always going to get those types. They're going to go run and grab a gun. You know, that can't be avoided. They're out there. Other people, however, will have to be calmed by, I would think, there are authorities, so they don't go into a panic state. But as soon as the initial shock is over, once we establish trade, and everybody gets to pitch their wares, you know, with another alien culture, like, hey, can we exchange things here? I mean, we could really mess with them. Can you imagine giving them some of the Chinese finger puzzles, you know, giving them a bag of those and letting those go down to the reptoid civilization? We'll keep a few of them busy for quite a while.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, John, I'm getting some feedback from you and a loud hiss. Can you turn back or do whatever you were doing before?
Okay.
So what is it, just a switch?
Yep.
Switch it all the way down. You're going to have to talk for me to hear.
Okay.
No, that's unacceptable. Totally. You there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, that's better. No, no. See, I'm getting horrible feedback now.
Okay, we'll switch out.
Can you just get onto a regular phone? John Rhodes here. It happens technically.
There we go.
Now? Yeah, but I'm getting feedback. So that's not working.
I'm on a landline.
Do you have anything else on?
No.
Are you by your radio?
Nope.
Oh, that's not going to work if we have that. So we'll do the best we can and see if we can fix it with you during the half here in about 15 minutes.
Okay, good enough.
So anyway, as we were saying, that these creatures seem to be prevalent and you think they're coming back home. Now, that's another possibility because you also believe they're earthbound.
Right. They appear to be those that have remained here on Earth and have, of course, influenced mankind to varying degrees. We also have those who are off Earth, probably exploring space just like we're trying to do now. And if you had the technology to get you thousands of light years away, which apparently they seem to be able to do, then there must be some large system out there they're interacting with. But we have beings that are here, and we have beings that are from other places, including, I believe, other dimensions. Because when we talk about death and we talk about the physical reality of death and how energy phase state just doesn't disappear, it changes and it goes somewhere, then we have to recognize that if we were humans, if most of the animals on Earth that dominated Earth history for 190 million years were dinosaurs and reptiles, that regardless of how many lifetimes we've come back as human beings, which are pretty much a newer form here on Earth, then really the inherent symbol that we would be attracted to psychologically, if there's something like a genetic memory, would be that of a snake or a serpent.
Well, it's conceivable that we're dealing with, as you've mentioned, different sources here. But what about, and let's talk about the ancients again. Ancient technology was prevalent, was written in the Vedas and in the Bible. But what do they say about reptoids?
When you're looking back in history, you're looking back at a record that is mixed with real events and imagined events. And it's very difficult to tell which is which. What we do know is that in ancient times, men once walked with something that was upright and had a reptilian physical signature to it. The terracotta figurines that were found in the ancient city of Ur that look like a mother and child, where the mother has a conical-shaped head, large slit eyes, and is holding a child that looks a little bit like a dinosaur to her chest, like she's suckling it, indicates that some of these beings may not have been entirely cold-blooded, as most people would think, but like dinosaurs, could have also been warm-blooded because it gives the impression of a mammary that they're holding them up to the breast to be fed, which makes sense, especially when you recognize that what we thought before as mammals, which was birds, we knew they were avians. We never thought they were that closely aligned with the dinosaurs.
Well, isn't it also amazing how in Egypt, the statues that they have and so many things that they've got inscripted on walls look like reptilian features?
Yes, they do, because it's the reason we see so many crests and family crests and flags all over the world that have the snake on it, and in ancient times upon the walls of the pyramid and the like, including in Central America, is because we have in the core of our brain, the reptilian brain, we inherit this from the genetic history a long time ago, when really all that was walking around here were reptiles and mammals, then came later. So this ancient stem of this memory, just like if people look at Beethoven or Mozart, they're conducting symphonies at five. Some people have memories of families they knew in past lifetimes. So there's something to do with genetic memory or some sort of memory that can be carried down through the ages. And when the ancients in the ancient world were traveling amongst each other, the shamans would set out and they would look out and send crews out to go establish contact with other cultures. What they did for their entertainment is take different types of mind-altering drugs that gave them visions. This was like old-time TV in your head. And they were able to beat the drums. They were able to stimulate and unlock different types of Jungian archetypal symbols and visions. And these visions that were the most prominent and cross-cultural around the world were those of the snake.
Is any of this tied into the apocalypse, John?
Well, it isn't as much as when you're talking about Revelation.
Uh-huh.
We have these return of the dragon, and if you think of it from an alchemical standpoint, you're really talking about like the Ouroboros with the snake with its tail in its mouth and making a circle. Because we start the Bible with a talking serpent in the garden, and then we end the Bible with the reappearance of the dragon. And also the time of 2012 and 2013 is a transition point between the Chinese Year of the Dragon and the Year of the Snake. In addition to that, the Year of the Dragon is Water Dragon, which also brings up the Age of Pisces. And at the same time, we have the transfer of Venus across the face of the sun between, which is the sister planet of Earth, which has been related to Jesus Christ, Quetzalcoatl, Lucifer, all of them, coming between Earth at a magical time when, you know what, we're going to be going through massive solar storms.
So you truly believe that one day, sooner than later, we may have these incredible visitations from these reptilians?
I do believe that we may one day have full open contact. I can only pray that it will happen in my lifetime, because I will gladly give up the position of being a researcher if we can finally find out what's really going on.
Maybe we already know, John. Maybe they're interacting with military or government. Is it possible?
I truly believe that that's the case.
You
there
do?
There are those here that have interacted with them. Colonel Corso said they've been exchanging goods and technologies. We're getting the short end of the stick, but we're willing to put up with it. We got the little gray mercenaries running around trying to create, you know, angst between every party.
And we feed them people every once in a while?
Well, you know
you
what?
You never know.
I have no idea. I know a few people I'd like to feed to a reptoid.
You know, we have all these people that disappear. They just fall off the face of the planet. How do we know they haven't been grabbed?
Well, we don't. We don't. And it gets us back to this thing about underground caverns, underground cities, underground bases. You know,
it's bad enough to be confronted. Can you imagine someone who might have gotten grabbed by one of these things and they're brought down to some underground cavern or city and they've been captured? Maybe they're put to work. Who knows what's happening?
Hey, look, Journey to the Center of the Earth, Jules Verne. They talk.
Great movie, too. Great book, great movie.
Look at the beings that they meet. They were little reptilian humanoid beings. Look at Dinotopia. A boy and his father go to a hidden world that where dinosaurs and humans are living side by side, coexisting. Look at, you have it repeated from all these big media outlets. We have to wake up and recognize the fact that we're about to go through some mind-blowing event during natural disasters, and we have to grab hold of this whole thing about this reptile within you, part of your Jungian ancient art complex brain that controls your subconscious. If you fear this subject matter, you will be psychologically out of balance.
How many do you think there are? There can't be that many. Few thousand? Few million?
I don't know. I would only, if the ones that we're meeting now, I can only imagine that maybe they have families, that that they have females, that there's some sort of a substructure, a social substructure that has existed.
There's a leader.
There's a leader. There's some sort of. We know that there's a caste system, so there has to. It's about physical looks. You know, your caste, and we know that there are two types. There are reptilian humanoids that could just as much slice you up and down like a dice and slice at the kitchen counter, as well as there are those that will lay down their life for you. And it's hard to tell which are which, just like there are when there's human beings and you interact with them.
Just my luck to get the former than the latter.
Just make sure you're sitting in a section where it's the vegetarians are all seated for dinner and not in the carnivore section.
Do you think any... No, I don't see how it can be, but do you think any of these creatures might have been... confused with Sasquatch or Bigfoot?
Yes, I do. I've had talks with Liston Truesdale down there in South Carolina where he's like, I don't get it, John. He says, these people talk about this thing, turn around, and all they could see is its chest, and there was this big hair. But at the same time, they say they leave three-toed footprints, and they look like they have feet of a dinosaur or a lizard or something. It's because we're encountering beings out there that are actually dressing up in skins and running around. So that causes a sense of confusion. If they're intelligent and they don't know they don't want to be recognized, I would think it would be smart of them to put on a bear skin and run around so you confuse you. People think you're maybe a bear from a great distance. Maybe they use them for clothing just like us, you know, or cavemen used to, and or people who are more savage in different parts, remote parts of the world. I shouldn't say the word savage, just more tribal. And so it's led people to think from a distance that they're really dealing with something that must be Bigfoot, because they're tall, as well as they're so broad-shouldered. And really, when you get a person in a state of shock, I don't think that most people can really, you don't think very fast when you're in shock.
Do you think that some of these creatures shapeshift? They look like human beings, but they shift back? I mean, some people have said, David Icke believes, that if you look at, and they tend to be in positions of power, that if you look at them, you can see their reptilian eyes when they kind of get angry. Do you believe that?
Well, I've heard of certain speakers that promote that idea that have been told to me that they've seen them shapeshift too. In other words, what we're talking about is it's easy to point an accusing finger at a leader and accuse them of such a thing, which they're never going to lower themselves to the standards of even responding to such a charge.
True.
Okay. And it's the same type of thing that's been used as a witch hunt before will be used again. Human beings, we just keep dropping to those levels where we'd like to blame people. To tell you the truth, I think that if
you think that's
alien culture, they're sitting on their chins and they're with their fists under their chins thinking, when are these people going to own up to their own personal responsibility of how they've really messed up their own planet?
Sure. Well, so you think the accusation of calling governmental leaders shape-shifting reptilians is nonsense?
Well, I couldn't say entirely, because I do believe that certain shapeshifters are out there, but I feel that the topic matter has been fully overblown just so it can alleviate us of some sense of responsibility for what we've done on our planet and point an accusing finger at some alien species that's not even going to come forward to answer the charge.
Do they communicate telepathically or, you know, with speech?
They communicate amongst themselves in clicks. And large, high pitch sounds, like a whistle, but it's a higher pitch.
Like a dolphin?
It could very much like that. And a clicking sound. They communicate with their human contacts telepathically, as well as an exchange of energy that seemed to be plasma in form, that had geometric shape, a very intricate geometric shape that seemed to be spinning around, that appeared in front of the reptoid's eyes and in thin air and came forward and entered the forehead of the human contactee. The human contactee reported heightened intelligence in areas beyond their natural educational levels, often getting into matters of electronics, lasers, different types of skill sets that could get them employment in different types of sensitive military-industrial complex positions.
Let's see, John, how this ties into the 2012, and then I know you want to talk about these incredible tube shuttles. We'll talk about that when we come right back. We're going to take your phone calls with John Rhodes at the top of the hour, but we'll be right back and talk with him about 2012 and how does this tie into these creatures of the night. John, we continue to monitor the year 2012 as we get closer and closer now. It's really starting to speed up. Tell me about your reptoid hypothesis in 2012. What's the tie-in there?
It does appear as that maybe the ancient Maya and others like them were shipwrecked or stranded after the sinking of a large continent. Some people might want to refer to it as Atlantis.
Okay.
And that when they washed up upon the shores of Central America, they met the indigenous natives there, and even though they didn't have the tools to do what they could do a long time ago in their own continent or country, they still had the intelligence to be able to direct the Indians, who might have looked at them as like arriving gods,
sure.
And been able, under their direction, to use natural and perhaps even alien technologies to help them continue their appearance like gods so that the people would cooperate with them. And that the Mayas and the descendants of the Mayas who are now living in Mexico may have known that perhaps there was this time when this fleet or advanced or exploring space fleet who left a long time ago was expected to come back, coinciding during times of natural cyclical disasters that we call global warming or solar variations and the like. And what we're seeing now out in Mexico City may just be a preliminary event or preliminary events compared to what's going to be going on in the future. We have videotapes coming out of there showing not one or two, but many, many of the anomalous objects in the air flying in formation over the skies of Mexico. So they've obviously demonstrated a large presence in that region. Were the British down there sneaking around looking for these underground reptoids? Could the Maya of long time ago actually retreated into the underground in Mexico, and Mexico's covered with caves and volcanic regions and such that have wonderful tube passages underground? Could they have come into contact with other intelligent beings like the reptoids that perhaps they were seeing on the surface from time to time and inherently attracted to them because they were so connected with that symbol of the serpent anyway? Could they be actually expecting something to be occurring around 2012? I would only say that we have to look as far as July 11th, 1991, during the solar eclipse over Mexico City, when they allowed themselves to be seen when they knew everybody would be looking skyward. So that was almost a sense of why would they do that. It obviously, from my perspective, said that they were there to point out something to do with their presence and the sun at the same time.
But these would be ETs then?
No, they could. I can't imagine somebody coming from light years away to feel that a solar eclipse on some planet that's not even theirs is really that remarkable of an event or that important. It would be more important to beings who live here, where this is their planet, this is their circle of space. And we could have extraterrestrial craft jetting in and out of there to see if they can push their airspace around. Remember, they're very much into this thing about your airspace, we can penetrate it just like we were with the Russians. You see that in 1952 when the White House had UFOs over them. That was our most secure airspace at the time. So all of a sudden they're showing us, oh, well, right over where your leader sits, we can control the airspace and you can't even chase us away. They've done it with the nuclear missile silos by going into sensitive airspace. They did it with the cattle mutilation this last year up in Valier. They were only 1 mile away from a nuclear missile silo launch point, which means that it's extremely sensitive airspace.
And you don't see them as violent. Hollywood depicts them as that.
Well, it's because it's a frightening image. It evokes a lot of genetic fear that we have in us because for so many millions of years, we used to be their food, mammals. I mean, we used to stay as far as we could away from snakes. Some people some scientists have said that we owe our evolution towards intelligence to snakes because we had to become smarter in order to avoid them. And so we have all these inherent fears that is played off of a lot in Hollywood, and right-wing groups, of course, get the information and they twist it to suit their purposes. It's awful what people do when you can take an image as neutral, you can turn in something good or bad like a snake, but you can use it to evoke reactions within people that are very primal.
Now, of course, we talk about the underground facilities as well. You've done some work into tube shuttles. Tell me about this.
Well, tube shuttles and underground facilities. For example, out in West Hampton, New York, Gabreski Airport at one time, there was where the 106th Command is, Air Support Command, they had a lieutenant colonel by the name of Anthony Cristiano. He was in charge of the base, and it was pretty much running at low speed. He had an airman come in and slap a report on his desk saying, what do you want me to do with this? And it turns out that the report was actually printed in 1940, and it was drawn up for the U.S. government to have an underground runway that could house up to 1,000 planes underground under Gabreski Airport in advance of a potential Nazi invasion during World War II. The United States had gone into an agreement with Canada at the time in October of 1940 in a unified agreement for for defense of our shores and the Canadian shores. And it was at that same time that this this document was drafted up. They said that the aircraft could actually leave the ground in flight through small openings in the earth, and that it would be totally protected from any kind of bombardment that the Germans might want to put down their throats. Now, considering that this is 1940, they were talking about the importance of building such an underground facility, you get the idea that we've had so many years that have passed since then that our government, in all its brilliance and all the money that we have allowed it to spend, has taken the world's greatest engineers and actually created a system of network of tunnels and underground cities inside the United States for preparation of continuation of government and also the human species in case anything happens on the surface. So we have that documented case. It turns out that the lieutenant colonel had retired, and the day he retired, he dropped dead from his job. The authors who penned the report are both dead, but their children are still alive. One of the author's children had said that his father was personal friends with Theodore Roosevelt and used to go out in the boat here to fish with him. And his father being a very well-known engineer in the area at that time. Remember, this is out towards Montauk, so this is the 1940s getting out into that really mysterious stuff.
Well, how many miles are we talking about of tubes?
As far as tube shuttle network?
Yeah.
We're talking about coast-to-coast being able to... what happened was that in 1972, a RAND scientist by the name of Robert Salter was interviewed with the L.A. Times, and he was their lead physicist, and he was interviewed, and the interview contained his report on how they had developed and designed a large tunnel network system across the United States that in an evacuated tunnel, meaning vacuum tunnel, they could drop a maglev train and have it travel in excess of 14,000 miles an hour from coast to coast with as little discomfort.
14,000 miles an hour?
14,000 miles an hour because it's in a vacuum.
That's like faster than a speeding bullet.
It's coast to coast in 21 minutes. Okay, now. They said they could do this with off-the-shelf technology and very few technological breakthroughs would have to be made. They said it was totally feasible. Robert Salter encouraged the construction of this because he said we have to free up our skies because of the pollutions we're putting into it. He said also because of the energy savings. The tube shuttle systems work on a way like the old trolley cars. When you accelerate one in one position, what's happening is when it gets to the median point, its deceleration at 7,000 or 7,000 miles an hour, the forces in its decelerating are being put back into the system to help the car in the opposite direction accelerate. So it's very.
How long would it take? Efficient. How long would it take to build coast to coast?
They claim that it would take some years to build. They were unspecific into how long it would take to build. Although they did say that. They believe that the military should take command in the construction of these tube shuttles for national security interests because everything else would fall in line. They said that they could accommodate up to, and at that time, 170 million passengers a year because they could have these tube shuttle trains have 1 minute separation before
the next one. Off. The next one, then the next one, I guess.
The next one and the next one. They said all you'd have to do is increase more. It decreased the time between departures, and you could actually put not very much work on the system and carry twice as many passengers. And they said that people would end up leaving the airlines and coming down to that because simply it's a good thing to do.
What kind of G-force would there be on people?
You're talking about when you're traveling in and speeds of 6,000 and 15,000 miles an hour. In order to make a comfortable turn of, and just maintain 1G, if you're traveling 550 miles an hour, it takes about 4 miles of a turn in order to maintain just that 1G, which is not too uncomfortable. The same thing, when you go 5,500 miles an hour, it takes about 400 miles to turn that, to make that turn. So really they have tube shuttle systems that take as little, as few turns as they can, and they encourage the construction of a hypervelocity tube shuttle that goes from San Francisco through Dallas up through Chicago or directly to New York.
So the tube would be the same too. It's not like we'd have multiple tubes on top of each other.
No, you could. What they did was actually they were designing 28 diameter cuts that using a subterrane, which is like a melting a boring machine. It's not ground, it's melting. So it actually creates a glass-lined rock that's really easy to create a vacuum in. And they were pointing out different technologies like this that they said they would use. The tubes they would put together are 28-foot diameter ones were done in almost an elliptical shape that could house two separate tubes. It would almost be like you're getting into a jet aircraft that has no windows, that has nice plushed seats and such. You're going to be accelerating sometimes for the first part of the trip where you'll feel an acceleration, and the majority of the trip you could actually kick back just like you were walking up and down in the cockpit of an airplane.
How much would this cost, John?
They said the initial costs actually would be most of it, 90% of it would go into the building of the tunnels.
Sure.
They said about 10% left over would go into the technology of putting the tubes in, and that it could run into the tune of $1 trillion, although you have to understand by you're taking the entire system and moving it underground, not just airline transportation, but you could take cross-continental communications lines, gas delivery lines, supply lines, communication lines, all of that could share the tunnels and help offset the cost for building it over a period of time. And what you do is the entire infrastructure of transportation back and forth, instead of being big rigs pouring pollution onto the into the air on the highways and clogging our highways up, we could have a tube delivery system that could be shooting these things across the nation at instances.
Oh, but John, I mean, to dig it out to make the tube.
It's not so bad, because I'll tell you why. When you're talking about, I have on my site, reptoids.com, we have a link up there right now that will show you some of these diagrams, the documents, and your listeners might really get a kick out of them. The patents for the original subterranes developed in 1972 by the Los Alamos Corporation are also up in there. What they do is basically melt through rock, and the slough that's created, the heated rock, and even soluble granite melts at about 2,000 degrees. So it's, anything can be gone through by heating it up. And what happens is it pushes all of this around to the outside lining of the tunnel into the cracks, and as it passes through, it cools down, so it leaves a 3-foot thick glass lining around the tunnel. This means you don't need all the concrete, you don't have as much stuff to carry out, as much muck to remove, you don't need all the steel. It's pretty much, and it's real airtight. This could be, with using that particular technology, it could have been done at a great cost reduction. But see, these technologies were used back in 1972, but you don't see them in commercial use today because there's so much money being made by giving, like, Ralph M. Parsons Corporation or Bechtel. All these guys get such big money laying down concrete and putting up pillars to justify the building of these tunnels.
Sure.
That it's a big industry to them.
Do you think these reptoids are using this kind of travel system?
The systems, the tunnels, glass line tunnels, have been discovered out there by people exploring around. So there is an indication that this technology is not new. Well, there's nothing new under the sun, right?
Well, it's kind of funny you say this, because there are some people who believe that there are glass tubes on the moon.
Oh, I believe that as well. Why should they have limited moving underneath the surface to just this planet? If I were going to Mars, why are these guys saying, well, we have to put all these capsules together to make a some place for them to a habitat on the surface? And this, you don't need that. All you have to do is an advance, send a subterrane that has a nuclear generator on it to the planet, remote control it, burrow out or melt out an entire system of tunnels that are airtight and have the machine shut down, produce oxygen. Now you have an environment for your space, your individuals, your astronauts and such, in which they could be living in. You could use then the natural minerals of the Earth to extract other things like water, as well as use it for power.
Well, how long
And they would be under the surface. Again, they don't have to worry about solar storms and cosmic rays and everything else.
How long do you think it would take just to bore through a mile, let alone 3,000 miles?
Well, I think that by now, if that technology was developed far into far surpassing what they had shown the public, that it's really got anybody's imagination.
I just don't see it as being practical, John.
In what way?
Logistics, being able to do this.
You would think that, but you know what? We're talking about a lead physicist with the RAND Corporation, one of the oldest and most famous think tanks, science think tanks.
What do they pay them for this thing, for this study?
The study, this particular study, was done in three parts, and it was continued in 1978. And by the time the second report or the third report came out in 1978, they said that they had already received logistical support from Ralph M. Parsons Corporation. Now, Ralph M. Parsons Corporation, Ralph Parsons was one of these guys who teamed up with Steve Bechtel of Bechtel Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And John McCone, who ended up being the head of the CIA, they formed a corporation together. And these were the guys that were way, way back in the 1930s before Halliburton and everybody else. Now,
yeah, but they had the formula.
In this technology.
They had the formula. Use taxpayers' money to line their own pockets.
Right. You're right. It's probably been happening since we've been firing slingshots and throwing
absolutely
rocks at each other. Some little guy off the side going, I got a pile of rocks here. But
pay for it from tax money, right?
Right. And so you have interest generated by people in the military-industrial complex towards this because they said it's not only feasible, we should be doing it. Now, one of the things I've known from my work with scientists, is, and especially engineers, is they love going underground. They love building tunnels.
Yeah, but 3,000 miles worth?
Hey, listen, in the 1970s, 8,000 miles of tunnels were dug around the world. In Sweden, they've taken their entire infrastructure, their military and parts of their continuity of government infrastructure, and put them into mountains. There is a report. Let me say something. I got to read this so I don't misquote it.
Well, I may have you read it when we come back because we're coming up to the break here, John.
But there are government documents that clearly say that just as much as we've explored the surface of the Earth and outer space, they think that we need to be going underground.
All right, interesting. All right, stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines next hour. John Rhodes, our guest, Reptoids. He believes that they could be living under Earth's surface, that they could always they could have been around here for a long time. Off-world, maybe other dimensions. You're next on Coast to Coast AM.